Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, China unveils new defense strategy. Business as usual in Seoul, South Korea, despite North Korean rhetoric. Illicit gun trade in the Philippines. And New Zealand, the first country in the Asia Pacific to allow same-sex marriage. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. China's Defense Ministry has released a report which it says will make its military and strategic intentions more transparent. Beijing's annual defense white paper has revealed a rise in military spending to $119 billion for the year 2013. It also highlighted China's concerns about territorial and maritime rights in the region, saying neighboring nations are taking actions that complicate or exacerbate the situation. But just how transparent is the new document on military spending? Sen Lam spoke to Dr. Mohan Melek, a professor of Asian security at the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii.
What struck me most was that this is the first time that a Chinese defense white paper has sought to justify an increase in China's defense expenditure in terms of U.S. rebalancing strategy. The reality is that China's defense expenditure has been growing at a rate faster than its economic growth rate. China's economy has grown over the last two decades at 10 to 12%, but China's military expenditure has grown at the rate of 12 to 17%, especially since 1996, with a few exceptions in between, from last year's $113 billion to this year's $119 billion.
And to what extent is that increased military spending driven partly by competing maritime territorial claims in the region?
This is very much driven by what is going on in the region. You cannot separate recent tensions between China and Japan on the Korean Peninsula, China and its Southeast Asian neighbors, China and India, and U.S. Decision to deploy 60% of its submarines and fleet in the Pacific. There is no denying the fact that overall balance of power is shifting. Almost a decade ago, China was weaker militarily, economically, than many of its neighbors, especially Japan, for example. Over the last 10 years, there has been a shift in balance of power, both economic and military, in China's favor. If you look at defense expenditures in the region, China's is the only one that is growing. Other defense expenditures, including that of the U.S., is declining.
And just this week, we had reports from Manila saying that the Philippine government may consider reopening the two former U.S. military bases at Subic Bay and Clark Air Base. How do you think this might go down in Beijing?
Of course, China will see this as a move to contain China. But what is amazing, those of us who monitor Chinese periodicals and media, print and electronic media, is that there's very little realization in China's policy community that countries like Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, India are driven by the need to protect their own interests. China's activation of its territorial disputes with all its neighbors is the major driving force that has pushed these countries, China's neighbors, closer to U.S. As they have become more dependent on China's economy for their growth and prosperity, they are moving closer to the U.S. for their military security.
A senior Chinese military spokesman says the white paper's release shows that Beijing is being very candid about its strategic intentions. Do you buy that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the Chinese government is obviously revealing more than it has in the past. There is no denying that. But what I would like to see is a breakup of dollar amounts, a Chinese currency that is spent on nuclear force modernization, maritime capabilities, cyber and space capabilities. We still do not have a very clear picture of how much money is being spent on China's nuclear force modernization. China is going to have the largest submarine fleet by the year 2020. So we need some more specific information about different categories of defense spending.
Dr. Mohan Malik, professor of Asian security at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii. Many South Koreans are breathing a sigh of relief after the birthday of North Korea's eternal leader, Kim Sung-il, passed without feared missile testing and other provocative acts. The threats from Kim Jong-un have sparked some protests in South Korea, but for most people, it's business as usual. So does the appearance of normality in Seoul keep deeper fears masked? Jim Middleton of ABC Television spoke to Jasper Kim, CEO of the Asia-Pacific Global Research Group.
Yeah, imagine another country attacking the island territory of another sovereign state. That would be not only just emotional fear, it'd probably be an outright act of war, as it's interpreted. So that would be something that would not just stay still. It would be something that would morph into something greater. But in South North Korea, these interrelations have been going on since the end of the Korean War in 1953. People are used to this. It's almost status quo. North Korea, it's calm, it's quiet, and then all of a sudden there's bellicose rhetoric, followed by unexpected actions, military or paramilitary, and then you have some type of huge event. But South Korea really doesn't have much choice. It has to stay calm and carry on, simply because if it reacts, then North Korea will also react in kind. It'll be a tit for tat, and it won't end very nicely if that happens.
So would you say then that it is the general expectation of ordinary people in South Korea that however inflamed the rhetoric is, however high the state of brinkmanship is, that they really do not expect whatever occurs will lead to actual military conflict that will endanger their lives?
Well, I think in the past that was certainly the case. With 99% confidence, I think no matter what North Korea did, short of sending its million-man army across the DMZ, South Korea had very little choice. It had its arms tied behind its back, simply because economically there's so much to lose for South Korea and also Japan and the U.S., militarily as well. There's so many people living here in Seoul, 10 million people, so close to the DMZ, so close to Pyongyang. So there's too much at stake to actually react. And that's where South Korea was in the past. But now things have been amped up a little bit. In terms of military, the Secretary of Defense here has given greater discretion for the military to respond in a proportional manner if and when North Korea acts provocatively.
What does it say then about the reality of public emotion in the South, that when ordinary South Koreans are polled, as they were recently, a significant majority does think that South Korea ought to have a nuclear device or devices of its own?
Well, I think you see something that's a great shift. I think people used to think of North Korea as its brothers, its sisters, long-lost relatives. We can trust them. After all, we are from the same culture, the same shared history,
The same language. People, still the same
and
people.
Also the same people. But when you have this type of sentiment, it's really kind of a shift in the psyche of the average South Korean, that there's a lack of trust now between North and South Korea. Because of this trust, people want a dialogue with the North. And there are still some portions and pockets of the population that want it now. But a growing consensus is growing for some defensive deterrence against North Korea in the form here of nuclear capabilities.
Does that mean then that given the public support and in fact the public will on this matter, that politicians will have to respond and that that of itself could make tension between North and South worse?
Well, I think definitely so. I think the politicians here are very cognizant of what the public are thinking, simply because the public is so vocal here. There's demonstrations every day, it seems, and so if the public feels strongly about it, it will certainly voice its concern to the politicians, either directly or through the form of mass rallies and social media here, all of which are used very extensively.
Does it paradoxically enhance the case and force the politicians, both in, especially in Seoul, but also in Washington, to step up their own efforts to try to get some legitimate dialogue going with the North so they're not forced into places they don't want to go by public opinion?
I think so. I mean, they're trying to control the narrative, kind of control the dance, if you will. Right now, there's been a lot of rhetoric on both sides, basically things that are warlike or near warlike, bellicose language. And so people realize if this goes too far, you really can't take that bullet back. You really can't take these words back once they're uttered. So why not just try to control the dialogue and basically speak with your other party leaders in Northeast Asia and just say, how do we ratchet these things down rather than up?
A basic question, given all you've said, do you think that ordinary Koreans now actually believe their nation will be reunited?
I think that sentiment goes up and down. There's ebbs and flows. Right now, we're kind of at a trough period. I think people are pretty concerned about what North Korea is doing, especially with the young leader, Kim Jong-un. He's so young, he's so untested, and people don't really know what to make of him specifically. And the rhetoric and the language that's being used so far, each singular event is not something that is completely devastating, but the totality of all these events packaged in such a short period of time, streaming across from north to south, is something that's very worrisome. So had he been older, had he had some more experience in the military to mature a little bit, I think people probably would have been a little bit less concerned. But now I think people are very concerned, and it makes them question, well, you know, Korea unification, that's something that a lot of people want inherently, emotionally. But then you think about it rationally, I think now people are starting to have some second thoughts.
South Korean popular culture has spread Asia-wide very successfully. Is there any evidence to suggest it's having any impact at all on the people of North Korea, for whom it would be something way outside the bounds of their normal lives and experiences?
Well, I think what's going to make Korea crumble is not missiles so much, or military might. It's going to be culture. It's going to be information. These things are basically a people. These underground DVDs, clips of Gangnam Style being shown in Pyongyang homes, although illegal, people are watching them. And they trust that. They know or they expect that this is what it's like just south of the DMZ. They don't trust the politicians outside of North Korea, but they do trust these videos and they like it. It's endearing. It's something that they want. And once a greater number of people want what's in South Korea, then things will begin to change dramatically.
Jasper Kim, the CEO of the Asia-Pacific Global Research Group, speaking to ABC Television's Jim Middleton. A spire of high-profile massacres and shootouts in the Philippines this year has once again brought the country's enormous and lucrative weapons black market under scrutiny. President Benigno Aquino himself, an avid sports shooter, has launched a campaign to get unlicensed guns off the streets. But in the Philippines, where guns are seen both as a status symbol and a weapon of personal safety, ridding the streets of gun is not as easy as it may seem. Kandahar Sapati speaks next to Ed Cantinero, an independent consultant on threat issues.
It's connected to the lack of trust that government can protect them. But it's also a kind of vicious cycle because it's also the security sectors, the police, that tell civilians you should protect themselves because we don't have enough capacity to protect you, something like that. But in the study that I made, the critical problem is that unlike other illegal economies where it's completely outside the law or completely illegal, the Philippine state has this absolute control of regulation and control of supply, so the complicity is really deep inside the state, and therefore the complicity of the state agents is, you know, significantly responsible for the proliferation of guns.
So basically, the supply and the demand for guns is coming through the government?
It has, yes. There is no gun manufacturer that can directly upload or unload supply to the market. It passes through the warehouse controlled by the Firearms and Explosives Office. So it's the government agency that sets the quota for imports and local production and then sets the limits before you can unload the supply to the market. And it also has control over confiscated weapons. But the problem is that throughout the years where illegal guns have been confiscated, there is no corresponding policy on decommissioning and destruction of weapons. We don't have a criteria for that.
So how committed is the government to actually bring some form of control to the number of guns that are on the streets?
Yeah, that's in fact the gap, because in the United Nations Program of Action, when you confiscate illegal weapons, you have to destroy them, decommission them. But there is resistance on the part of the Philippine government to accede to that rule, because the argument is that there is not enough budget for the security forces, so that what guns you can confiscate may be used again by the security forces. So then you confiscate guns, you store them, but there is no rule with regards to destruction. There is no criteria on what type of guns would be destroyed. So it's really putting back the guns to the hands of state agents. And if the guns are confiscated in the provinces, you don't know where they are stored. So there is this thin line between the confiscated guns that should disappear in the market. You know, it's probably resold or distributed again.
So basically, there's a real open case of corruption, isn't it, going on?
Yes, yes, there is. Even if you look at the data on export and import, there is data reported by Philippine Customs, and there is data reported by the exporting countries to the Philippines, and it's monitored by the UN Commission on Trade. There is a big discrepancy between the numbers and the values imported. So the general tendency is underreporting of volume and value. And it's connected to the whole discussion right now about the corruption at the Bureau of Customs.
To what extent is this presence of guns impacting on the state of security on the streets?
Yeah, that's the strangest thing, because like more than 70% of illegal guns would be in Luzon, and like 80% of that would be in Metro Manila, where you have the national center, you have the headquarters of the police, the armed forces, etc. So it's ironic that where you have the center of power, you would also have the largest number of illegal guns. And it feeds into crime. But if you look at, again, I mean, this is also the other dilemma, because if you look at the guns in the hands of crime groups and rebel groups, it's less than 1% of total number of legal and illegal guns. So it's not feeding into the vertical conflict, into rebellion. It's not really feeding into organized crime groups. The gun is being used by civilians generally for protection. It's in the house, you carry it, and, you know, in the face of crime and criminals, you use it for yourself because you don't trust the police.
So are we seeing a gun culture in the Philippines that's quite similar to that in the U.S.?
Well, not in the sense of, you know, shooting people. It's more in the sense of protecting myself, for example. It's also in the sense in rural areas, it's a sense of looking at the gun as some kind of jewelry that you can sell again, buy again, sell. And in times of emergency, you can sell it to pay for medical bills. And it depends also on income class, because for the upper classes, it's a social status.
Legalizing same-sex marriage is a hot issue around the world. New Zealand has become the 13th country in the world to legalize same-sex marriage, with more than 70% of the population agreeing with this change. We have this story from Dominic Schwartz.
The result was no real surprise.
The ayes are 77, the noes are 44.
But the chamber erupted anyway. There were hugs for the architect of the marriage equality bill, opposition Labour MP Louisa Wall, as politicians and the public gallery burst into Pokari Kari Ana, a traditional love song.
Nothing could make me more proud to be a New Zealander than passing this bill. I thank my colleagues for simply doing what is fair, just and right.
Advocates for same-sex marriage in New Zealand had already begun celebrating. This couple, already bound in civil union, is now planning to marry, officially.
It's just really about human rights, about us having exactly the same rights as anyone else.
It means that we can actually call each other wife.
Married gay couples will also be eligible to adopt.
We're seeing a failure of democracy. We're seeing the politicians make a decision tonight that the people of this country wouldn't make.
Supporters of same-sex marriage in Australia hope the New Zealand vote will help force change across the Tasman.
It's disappointing that New Zealand is going to beat Australia to it, because what's been evident around the world is where states or nations embrace marriage equality, there is real excitement in the streets and it becomes a real draw card.
And potential money spinner.
It's been estimated that if same-sex couples were allowed to marry in Australia tomorrow, they would spend at least $700 million on their weddings. A lot of that wedding spend will now go to New Zealand.
Dominique Schwartz, ABC News, Auckland.
Refugee advocates have been criticising all along the PNG Manus Island Detention Centre. Now, Australia's Immigration Department has come forward and criticised its own processing centre on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island. It says living conditions in the temporary camp are putting people at risk of illness, mental health problems and self-harm. A parliamentary submission also points out the urgent need to establish a permanent facility for asylum seekers, as under the current government policy, people will be held there for an extended period. Karen Barlow has more.
In a submission to a parliamentary inquiry, Australia's Immigration Department admits its own centre in Papua New Guinea is not up to scratch and is contributing to behavioural problems and illnesses. The military tents are hot and humid, there's drinking and power supply problems, and the camp itself is in a low-lying swamp, a known mosquito breeding area. This assessment is no surprise to Ian Rintoul from the Refugee Action Coalition.
Look, it's a refreshing bit of honesty from the Immigration Department. I mean, the complaints have been made by people who've been transferred there from the beginning. You know, people who've inspected the place, have also sent back similar kinds of comments about the inadequacy of the facilities and the problems that are associated with it.
The Regional Immigration Processing Centre on Manus Island was set up quickly last year to deter boat arrivals, as recommended by an expert panel led by former Defence Chief Angus Houston. Another was set up in Nauru for single male asylum seekers. Manus Island takes single males as well as family groups. Now 5 months into operation, the Immigration Department admits that temporary living arrangements are contributing to increased tensions and what it calls problematic behaviour. Temperatures reach 38 degrees, but despite pedestal fans, transferees complain about very hot and humid conditions inside the tents. The tents and floors themselves are deteriorating in the wet. The supply of both power and drinking water are unreliable, and the department says there's little in the way of recreation and amenity. It says a temporary centre on Manus Island is cramped and the facilities are limited and in a poor state. This, it says, is contributing to boredom and behavioural problems. Ian Rintoul is in contact with people inside the camp.
Look, the people are despairing. We've just seen a mass hunger strike where 70 people, 70 of the single adult males, including two who'd stitched their lips together, that's only just ended because people are in despair. The word from the family camp, I could go on about their description of the conditions, the lack of water and electricity, as we've described before. In particular, people are, it's beyond anger over the lack of the medical facilities. So you've got 250 people, including 29 children, still on Manus Island.
The Immigration Department and the Immigration Minister, Brendan O'Connor, have been unavailable for comment today on the submission. At a press conference, the Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, sidestepped the issue when asked about conditions for asylum seekers on Manus Island.
Well, what we would most want to see is that the opposition would join with us in enabling us to put into full operation all of the recommendations that Angus Houston, the former chief of our Defence Force, and his very expert panel recommended to the nation. That's really the key thing we need to do.
The opposition spokesmen on immigration and border protection have been unavailable today. The main point of the submission to the Public Works Inquiry is the push for new permanent facilities. The Immigration Department says Australian standard permanent facilities are urgently needed because the government's policy of a no advantage principle for people arriving by boat means that transferees will be housed at Manus Island for what it says is an extended period of time. Under the current conditions, the department warns there's an increased potential for mental health problems and cases of self-harm. The department's submission was written while there was a temporary freeze on Manus Island transfers, and shortly after 19 people, including 6 pregnant women, were flown to the mainland, some for medical treatment. Transfers to Manus Island have now resumed, but there hasn't been an official explanation as to why transfers were stopped. The Papua New Guinea government has been pushing for permanent facilities, especially as there are children in the centre. Ian Rintoul says the centre needs to be closed.
Look, there should be no more transfers to Manus Island. The discussion now should be how it's going to be closed and how quickly people could be transported from Manus Island, you know, back to the mainland.
Australia's Immigration Department says construction of the permanent Manus Island facilities is expected to begin in July at a cost of $172 million. The Papua New Guinea government has not agreed to a site for the facility, which may put the timeline for the project at risk.
And with that report from Karen Barlow, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to let us know what you think of the program and where you heard it, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. If you wish to listen to this program again or catch all past editions, you can visit our website, which is www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. You can listen to this program through iTunes and also through Stitcher Smart Radio, so do go and check it out. So on behalf of everyone that helped put this week's program together, I'm Keith Perron, hoping that you can join us in 7 days' time for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Until next time, so long and take care.
Hear PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news, talk, and entertainment mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher from the App Store. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.
This is PCJ Radio International.
Call the PCJ answer line at country code 44-20-3286-1399. That's country code 44-20-3286-1399 and leave your comments and questions. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet, this is PCJ Radio.